fake news, alternative facts, hyper-partisanship, nostalgia for a time when the nation was truly great, a fear of immigrants and those who are different. Sound familiar? Well, they do to Jason Stanley. He says all are signs of fascist politics at work. He's published a new analysis of the methods of fascist politics with the goal to help readers resist their toxic effects. It's called How Fascism Works, The Politics of Us and Them. Jason Stanley is the Jacob Urowski Professor of Philosophy at Yale University and also the author of the 2016 book, How Propaganda Works. He joins us this morning here on the Jefferson Exchange. Good morning.
Good morning. Thanks for having me on the show.
Thanks for being with us. So, Jason, in our current American political environment, fascist is one of those all-purpose insults that's typically lobbed by the left at anybody on the right, just like communist is still used as an epithet in the opposite direction. But you get the sense that a lot of people who are using those terms as insults don't really have much of a clue what they really mean. So, in the context of your book, what exactly is your definition of fascism?
Well, fascism is an extreme right, extreme far right ideology that is a politics of emotion based on power and loyalty to a race, an ethnicity, and a culture that marshals emotion to displace reason and truth. And it displaces reason and truth by appeal to fear, for example, when you have a hierarchy of authority. Fear keeps hierarchies in place. So, you know, fear is what keeps you close to the leader, because the leader is going to protect you from the forces that he fulminates against. Disgust is central in fascist politics. So the goal in fascist politics is to replace kind of reasoned, dull policy debate by narratives that call up these overwhelming emotions like fear, disgust. So, you know, the out-group is always, they're always rapists. The men of the out-group are rapists, they're predators, they're here for your, quote, women, unquote. The leader's going to protect you. You've lost something valuable. So fascism is, my book gives a 10-part characterization of fascism, but generally it's a politics of emotion that seeks to replace reason and truth by a hierarchy of power and loyalty based on nationalism or ethnicity.
So your subtitle of the book, The Politics of Us and Them, is The Politics of Us and Them. And so is that the absolute essence of the politics of fascism, us and them?
Well, no, because there's many kinds of politics that take the form of us and them. Fascism is one kind of way of cleaving a distinction between us and them. Class-based politics is a way of cleaving a distinction between us and them. I mean, it's not just fascists who rage against the elites. I mean, there are legitimate reasons to rage against elites. So left-wing politics rages against the wealthy. So it creates an us-them distinction based on class. And in moments of extremism, communism, certain kinds of communism are extreme forms of the left. Fascism is extreme form of right-wing politics. Fascism requires smashing class consciousness. Because the other way of cleaving an us versus them distinction is by talking about the rich versus us, the poor or the middle class or whatever. So fascism has to smash the other ways of cleaving us versus them distinctions and replace them by this us versus them distinction based on race, based on religion, based on culture.
And in some cases based on education as well.
Based on education as well. Well, fascist politics always appeals to the least educated. So Hitler in Mein Kampf says the most effective propaganda targets the least educated among us. He lampoons people who critique demagogues for speaking sort of like idiotically or speaking in a simple way or repetitiously. And he said, no, repetitive emotional appeals, the appeals to the least educated among us, those are the effective appeals. That's the fascists' target audience, is lesser educated people. although, of course, many very well-educated people have fallen for fascism because, face it, the myths they spin are quite dramatic and attractive.
So you, in your book, How Fascism Works, and by the way, we're speaking with Jason Stanley. He's the author of this new book, How Fascism Works, and you can join us by phone if you have questions at 800-838-3760. You describe what are sort of the 10 pillars of fascist politics in your book, and I want to spend the rest of the hour kind of, we can't probably touch on every one of the 10, but I want to take a dive into some of them in more detail. And the first is the mythic past. And of course, we saw this in the 2016 presidential election with the phrase, Make America Great Again.
Right. So as I said, fascist politics is a politics of emotion. So it seeks to connect it. The goal, when you know fascist politics is taking hold, when the dominant group feels incredibly victimized. They feel victimized by encroaching gains by minority groups. So the way you do that, the trick you make to make them feel victimized, is give them this image of a mythic, wonderful past where men were men and getting the appreciation they deserve, and the members of the dominant group ruled over the rest of the people benevolently, perhaps. They had military conquests, and everything was wonderful. And then you connect economic anxiety, loss of status, with this loss of this fictional past.
And then we're talking with Jason Stanley, author of How Fascism Works, and we're going to explore the mythic past in greater detail in just a moment here on the Jefferson Exchange. After a break, we'll be back in 60 seconds. Back on today's edition of the Jefferson Exchange, we're talking with Jason Stanley. He's a professor at Yale University and the author of a new book, How Fascism Works, The Politics of Us and Them. And just before the break, we were talking about one of the 10 characteristics of fascist politics that is explored in the book, the mythic past, and we were looking at Make America Great Again. So, Jason, I imagine that for many, the great time of America was maybe the 40s or 50s, but this is one of those things that everybody sort of has their own idea of, and it's not very well defined. I imagine it's different for everyone, sort of a very hazy moving target. But you mentioned in your book that the only time that President Trump mentioned when America was great again was the 1930s.
Bannon said that in Hollywood
Reporter.
Oh, Bannon,
I'm sorry, yeah.
And that's a time when there's, of course, some clever messaging going on there. Because on the one hand, Bannon can signal economic nationalism because of the New Deal. On the other hand, of course, this administration is not practicing any kind of economic policies of that sort. There are massive tax cuts for the wealthy. So on the other hand, the 1930s is a time when America has its most sympathy for fascism. You have the America First movement. The America First movement was an explicit movement to ally the United States with Germany and seal the borders from immigrants. So you had, and of course, it's Mr. Trump's, one of Mr. Trump's slogans is America First. So there's no code words here. So Charles Lindbergh, the spokesperson for the America First movement in the 1930s and 1940, talked about sealing the borders from the Mongols and to keep the white race pure.
So I was really struck by a quote you have in the book from Benito Mussolini, where he says, "We have created our myth. The myth is a faith, a passion, and it is not necessary for it to be a reality." So even though everybody sort of has this hazy idea of America was great sometime in the past, it's not even important that we are specific about when that was, is it?
Well, just a note, I'm not sure black Americans are have a hazy idea that America was great in the past. So, or women, for that matter. The mythic past is supposed to be a myth. It's supposed to be, because you have to, a lot of the pillars of fascism are about displacing reality and truth. because if you're going to, you want to smash truth and replace it by power. So you want to offer people these attractive myths, and it doesn't even matter if they know they're myths. And that's what Mussolini is saying. Mussolini is saying, we're going to get people to, like, feel warm and fuzzy about this myth, in his case, the Roman Empire, and when we were great. And then we want them to feel outraged, to connect all their sense of loss and failure with loss of this myth, of this mythic past. And then we're going to use that to change the present.
And, you know, we've been speaking about examples from, of course, recent American politics, but as you point out in your book, Viktor Orban in Hungary is using this same method. So Hungary now has its mythic past. Poland has a mythic past. Even Myanmar.
Yes. They're all erasing their actual past. Hungary in the fundamental law, the 2011 constitution, begins with saying the constitution will make Hungary great again. Orban is constantly returning to the time when Hungary faced the Ottoman Empire to save Christian Europe. So this is Erdogan in Turkey is talking about the mythic past as that of the Ottoman Empire when Turkey was glorious. So this is just a regular theme.
We're speaking with Jason Stanley this morning. His new book is called How Fascism Works, The Politics of Us and Them. If you'd like to join the conversation this morning by phone, you can call us at 800-838-3760, or you can send us an email. Our email address is jx@jeffnet.org. Jason, I want to move on to another one of the 10 categories that you talk about in your book, which is anti-intellectualism. And this has been a strain in American culture for a long, long time. I mean, we have the popular figure in America of the educated fool, you know, the person that goes off to college and then can't even tie their own shoes afterwards, let alone shoe a horse. So that's been a strain in American culture for a long time, but now it's being used in a very different way, isn't it?
Yes, the universities are targeted. As I said earlier, Hitler talks about the most effective propaganda being the ones that reach the least educated. And the idea is to sort of lampoon the educated classes and represent them as dangerous communists. So when fascist politics always emphasizes the idea that, like, that there's an elite cabal of communists or sometimes Jews that are running the media, running the universities, and ideologically brainwashing everyone. You know, in Nazi Germany, they called the mainstream press die Lügenpresse. The idea was that people use the tone of objectivity and reasonableness to hide devious leftist communist agenda. Sometimes it's a devious capitalist agenda. So you find this. You find this in Poland's politics. You find it in Russia's politics. You find it throughout the world right now. Universities are being attacked. European University of St. Petersburg was closed down for liberal indoctrination and gender studies. And we find similar attacks in the university in the United States right now. People attacking universities as bastions of leftist ideology and the idea is to represent intellectuals as sort of dangerous threats and scientists as really, really having some devious agenda. Like, for instance, climate change is supposed to be a devious agenda to a devious mask, a devious progressive agenda.
And you mentioned also David Horowitz in your book. He is a major figure in attacking universities. He actually started his national career as a leftist. He was, I believe, an editor of Rampart's magazine back in the 1960s, but sort of had a major change in ideology, and he's a big force behind attacks on American universities.
He is, and he attacks American universities for gender studies, because he's very pro on the side of the Likud party in Israel, very pro sort of right wing Zionism. He attacks Middle Eastern studies. Targets professors individually and by name in his dangerous, most dangerous professors books. He really set the model for the more mainstream attacks on universities that we've seen in recent years. So, and he's also the person who is really the mentor to a number of the most far-right members of the Trump administration, such as Stephen Miller.
Now, do you see this working out in the Trump administration's education policy? I mean, what do you make of Betsy DeVos, for example, and her efforts to promote charter schools and, you know, let for-profit universities off the hook for defrauding students?
Betsy DeVos is taking some of the memes of the attacks on the universities. The other day, she actually took she actually cited Jonathan Haidt, who I respect a great deal. But he has let his message be appropriated. I think he's fighting against us. But she said, you know, universities can either worship truth or social justice. So the idea there is to paint certain universities as hiding the truth and really Marxist dens of Marxist ideology. And so you see that vocabulary. You had Betsy DeVos, an attorney general, the attorney general of the United States, showing up at a Turning Points USA conference. Turning Points USA has a watch list of professors, of leftist professors. That is terrifying, that the highest figures, the most senior figures of the president's administration are showing up at an organization that targets professors for leftist ideology. I mean, we can't forget that this is a country that had the McCarthy era. So we have, you know, the Department of Education, the recent changes at the Department of Education, the new head of civil rights, the Department of Education, has made this bewildering change to make criticism of Zionism one version, a legitimate kind of anti-Semitism. So you could threaten to take a university's federal funding away for a class being taught that has elements that are critical of Zionism on Title VI grounds. So at one and the same time, we find this clear hypocrisy. We find that's obviously chilling on free speech. On the other hand, they're using free speech as a way to attack leftists, painting leftists as somehow enemies of free speech.
And, you know, again, returning to another contemporary example in Hungary, Viktor Orban just simply took over the universities, didn't he?
Well, he the best university in Hungary is Central European University. And Viktor Orban's Fidesz party, under his commands, essentially closed down Central European. It's not closed down, but they de-accredited it. So they can't anymore take students in their Budapest University. And if you think that's just Hungary, look at the state of Wisconsin. The University of Wisconsin was one of the greatest universities in the world. The state of Wisconsin, Governor Scott Walker, has taken an axe to one of the greatest universities in the world that the people in Wisconsin are so fortunate to have in their state. And of course, Wisconsin, a proud labor state, and University of Wisconsin has one of the great sociology departments ever, and the state willingly is dismantling their own great state university, and faculty are fleeing. So this is universities. You look at Hungary, you say, how could they go after the accreditation of their best university? Well, in these times, I mean, in fascist politics, you go after your enemies.
Our guest this morning is Jason Stanley. He is a professor of philosophy at Yale University and author of a new book called How Fascism Works, The Politics of Us and Them. You can join the conversation this morning by phone at 800-838-3760 or by email jx@jeffnet.org. So, Jason, another major category that you discuss in your book is law and order. This was a big platform of Richard Nixon's, is always kind of recircling through American politics, and we hear it now a lot from the current administration.
Absolutely, and it's bizarre because you hear law and order from the current administration when there are clear violations of law and order happening all through this administration. So there's a fascist politics involves this kind of hypocrisy. So Jeff Sessions in November 2016 said about then-President-elect Trump that you could tell that he was a law and order president from his, he's going to be a law and order president from his reaction to the Central Park 5 case. Well, the Central Park 5 case was when five completely innocent 14 to 16 year olds were accused of a terrible rape in Central Park and imprisoned, and Mr. Trump called for their execution at the time, and they were innocent. And Mr. Trump throughout the election, at times during the election campaign, kept saying that they were eventually exonerated and given a cash settlement. And Mr. Trump questioned the cash settlement and kept on insisting at various points, I think, that they were guilty or they should have been, they shouldn't have been released or something. Certainly shouldn't have been given a cash settlement, according to him. But what conception of law and order is that? It isn't, you know, justice. What it is, you know, the out-group men are in and of themselves violations of law and order. And that's what you find time and time again. The out-group, the law and order in fascist politics means they are criminals and we are law-abiding. And Nixon, you know, Nixon did this in the 1960s. He painted political protests as riots. The protests in Watts and Detroit and Harlem were protests against police brutality. Some of them turned violent and then were represented as riots rather than protests. It was their actual function and purpose was completely ignored. And the image of quote-unquote rioting black Americans was then weaponized, and Nixon promised to shut it down.
So these particular ways of viewing the current status of the country, you know, law and order, we're under attack, et cetera, seem to be particularly immune to rational argument. Because if you look at the crime statistics that are released by the federal government, violent crime, other types of crime really are no worse and in many cases much lower than they were 20, 30, 40 years ago.
No, they're at completely historic lows. I mean, Mr. Trump, when he was campaigning, took advantage of a simple mathematical fact that when violent crime is at absolute historical lows, a very small increase will be a large percentage increase. So, you know, if you have 300 murders in New York in a year versus, say, 2,300 as in 1991, then 30 more murders will be a large percentage rise. But that's a 10% rise, and that sounds terrifying. But, you know, it's still 330 murders compared to 2,300. So there was just absolutely no, I mean, we're at, you know, violent crime is close to historic lows in the United States. And, you know, and it was at historic lows in the past couple of years where, you know, there are a few hot spots, but if you look at the explanations for the hot spots, like Baltimore and Chicago, they have to do with poor policing practices and some other factors. So, the entire idea of at least when Nixon was running, there were protests that turned violent. When Mr. Trump was running, violent crime was near historic lows, and immigrants, of course, are much less prone to violent crime than native-born Americans, and yet President Trump is able to create this wave of fear and paranoia out of nothing.
And then you hear the argument that the very fact that an immigrant would cross the border into the United States illegally makes them a criminal.
Absolutely. You heard that. I wrote a piece for the New York Times in May 2017 about this. This way of making, I mean, of course, the term criminal makes people afraid. This is the point in fascist politics, to make people afraid, and then produce yourself as their protector, the only one who can protect them. So when you hear criminal, you tremble with fear. But, you know, someone, you know, crossing the border, should that make you tremble with fear, trying to flee violence or get a better life for their children? Should that make you tremble with fear? So the word criminal is sort of imbued with this fearsome quality. And the goal is, so this happened before in the 1930s. My grandmother writes this about this in her memoir of the Holocaust. The Nazis said they were just targeting criminal Jews. And they started arresting Jewish German Jews with who just had traffic tickets. And they would say, hey, look, they're criminals. So this way of making very freighted and heavy terms like criminal, trivializing them, is deeply worrisome. If you run after a bus, you're not a runner.
Jason Stanley is our guest this morning. He's a professor of philosophy at Yale University, the author of the 2016 book, How Propaganda Works, and has just released a new book called How Fascism Works, The Politics of Us and Them. We'll be back in just a few moments here on the Jefferson Exchange, and we're going to start hitting the phones and emails as well. If you'd like to participate, 800-838-3760 or by email jx@jeffnet.org. Back with Jason Stanley in just 60 seconds. Final segment on this morning's Jefferson Exchange here on Jefferson Public Radio. I'm John Baxter, substituting today for Jeffrey Riley. Our guest is Jason Stanley, talking about his new book, How Fascism Works, The Politics of Us and Them. Jason, I want to start this last segment with an email we just received from Peter in Ashland, who writes, is there a particular skeleton key for dealing with fascist propaganda? It seems it doesn't matter how much evidence you use or what arguments you choose when people are willing to ignore what you're saying.
Right, because the point of fascist propaganda is to move things past the realm where truth and reality matter, because either because there's a deeper truth the leader is pushing or because people just lose all grip on truth. Truth is complicated and involves a lot of subtlety. So what you do in fascist politics is just create these myths. You give people these simple conspiracy theories that enable them to sort of like align themselves into us versus them factions. And then, you know, it's us versus them, and not and truth and argument are gone. And when that happens, it's very difficult because that happens, you know, in some sense, fascist politics is already won because, all that's left is loyalty. And when it's all that's left is loyalty, you don't have democratic deliberation. So, right, he's asking what to do.
Yeah, right.
Right. Well, what to do is, this is always a very difficult question, but remind people of common humanity. Remind people, we need way. Harken back to our American ideals. The civil rights movement did this. It sort of shocked people into seeing empathy again, into seeing that, wow, look at how harshly people are being treated and inhumanely. And so it shocked people into seeing the effects of hate. So we have to have ways of reminding people of our common humanity and getting beyond these sort of my tribe is over here, I'm white and I'm being threatened. But these are difficult times, and if there were some skeleton key for responding, then I would have written that book.
Okay. Well, we have a similar question this morning from Wolfgang in Sunny Valley. Good morning.
Good morning. Yes, I did have a similar question. I can skip that one. However, we're looking at, is there a political answer to that? And one of the problems that I see is what's called postmodernism, which in itself questions definitions, questions realities, tries to expand perceptions to a degree that it almost, if you change a few names and a few terms, it could almost serve as alternate fact base, right? So to what extent are these, quote, progressives or liberals in their methodology playing into the hands of the fascists?
Danke für Ihre Frage. Thank you, Wolfgang. So postmodernism. We have, I think Wolfgang's absolutely right that postmodernism can be a serious problem. We know that some of the postmodern theorists, we know from work like on Russia, that some of the postmodern theorists affected Russian political technologists who said, yeah, there's no reality. Reality is a myth. And this sort of affected some of the techniques that RT, for example, has employed, according to Peter Pomerantsov, the British journalist. So postmodernism questions reality, says there is no truth, everything is relative. That's one version of postmodernism, probably a cartoon version. However, the link between postmodernism and progressives seems dubious to me. I mean, Marxism is by its nature anti-postmodernist. I mean, Marxism is a kind of materialism. So insofar as people are calling for a return to material class struggles and the facts about power, they're asking for things to be grounded in reality. And so furthermore, the heyday of postmodernism in universities was the 1990s. It's not the case that because people want, that postmodernism is the dominant philosophical view in women's studies departments or in critical race theory, you find many more people who are devotees of reality and actual history. So I agree with Wolfgang that postmodernism can be problematic, but I disagree that it's linked in any sort of intimate way to progressivism or to what's happening in universities today.
Jason Stanley is our guest this morning. His new book is called How Fascism Works, The Politics of Us and Them. Another email this morning, this is from Jeffrey in Ashland. He says, while Hitler's Germany was eventually defeated, if the United States, with the most powerful military in the world, became a fascist nation, what would happen to the world order, and what can be done to defuse this trend before it's too late? And I want to point out also, in before we answer that question, Jason, that you mentioned frequently in your book that a country can suffer from fascist politics without itself being necessarily fascist.
Right. And my book is about fascist politics, not fascist government. I think there are lots of differences between countries that were taken over by people who practiced fascist politics. And nowadays, what you have in this new kind of authoritarianism, in this new kind of sort of heyday of fascist politics across the world, you find people keeping the trappings of democracy. So they hold elections. The elections have less and less meaning and significance. But so this is what Viktor Orban calls illiberal democracy. The question is very difficult to answer, and I don't want to go there. But I just want to say that, as you say, I mean, my book is about fascist politics, and a country has a political culture, and that political culture can be liberal democratic, or it can be fascist, or it can be something else. My worry is that we are changing our political culture. We are regularizing harsh attacks, harsh treatment with family separations of human beings, of our fellow human beings, having people's six-year-old daughters taken away, and sons. We're regularizing that. And liberal democracy has human rights as a core tenet, has equal dignity for all humans. And fascist politics erodes our democratic culture. And so my concern is not so much a fascist government and sort of, a la 1930s Germany. It's that our democratic culture is taking enormous hits. And those kinds of cultural effects, when people no longer care about facts and policy but are comforted with myths, when open white nationalism is tolerated as normal, I see this with young people. They're starting to think that it's normal. Then our democratic culture of equal respect and respect for the truth and liberty, because when you're taken over by myth, you're not free. You're operating under delusion. Those take great hits. So I'm worried about our democratic culture taking hits. I'm not yet worried about a fascist takeover and elimination as much as, you know, yeah, we're making ourselves very susceptible to authoritarianism.
Here's another call from Phil in Eureka. Good morning.
Hello?
Hello, Phil. Go ahead.
Yes, hi. I'm enjoying your show. This subject regarding myth and regarding facts and non-facts, you know, the issue of the that came out in the Washington Post a while back, and I think this was before Trump was elected, about this group, Proper Not, they came up with a list of sites that were suspect of being propaganda and not the real facts. And, the reality was, I mean, from my point of view, was that there was an effort taking place to try to create this fake news type of a scenario so that people could doubt sources and people could start defaulting over to other sources. I'll take your comment off the air.
Right. So, hello?
Yeah. Go ahead.
So I discuss this in a chapter of my book called Unreality. That's the explicit strategy. It's just to create so much uncertainty about the truth that the truth gets, nobody knows what's true. So it doesn't matter. This is a familiar point, but I'll say it again. It doesn't matter that people buy into an alternative narrative. What's important is they lose their grip on truth, that nobody knows what the facts are. It doesn't matter that they buy into an alternative narrative, that they firmly, because once there's so much unclarity about reality, then all people have to go on is loyalty. And when all you have to go on is loyalty and group identification, you've lost your democratic culture. So all those sites you saw, they're all trying to give everyone, no matter what their political affiliation, some kind of narrative to back them up, to undermine our connection to reality. And our connection to reality is what creates a commonality between all of us. When we all share the same source of basic information that links us with what's happening, it's grounding. And we can always check each other. We can say, no, that's wrong. Look over here. See, that's our common source. When we lose that common source, democracy trembles.
We have time for just one other call here. I want to get Tony in Talent. Good morning. We just have a few moments, Tony, so be quick if you can.
No doubt. This is Tony from Talent. Thank you. I'm just wondering an aspect of current fascism is, and in fact all politics, is very strange. We have anti-Semitism is now rife in the British Socialist Party, and Hungary, which you have decried, as of others, as being semi-fascist, is the safest place for a Jew to walk the streets of Budapest. Now, what's happened to anti-Semitism? Do fascists love the Jews now, or how do you account for this?
Okay, so this is a complicated, great question, complicated question. Hitler's anti-Semitism was not hatred of Zionism in Israel. Israel didn't exist during the Nazi period. Israel arises in 1948, and Israel is itself a nationalist project. It's, to some extent, it's a nationalist project. It's about giving Jewish people, like myself, a soil. And so Israel, the right wing in Israel, is aligned with a lot of far-right parties, because the right wing in Israel is ultra-nationalist, and they are aligned with Viktor Orban. Netanyahu is aligned with Putin. He's aligned with Orban. He's aligned with Trump. Israel has the right wing in Israel. There's still a socialist left wing that demands a return to socialist and egalitarian secular policies of original Zionism. But the right wing in Israel has been harshly right wing and nationalist, and they're linked to many of the far-right nationalist, indeed fascist, politicians throughout the world.
So, Jason, we just have a moment left. I want to get back to the idea of unreality here and the earlier email we got about a skeleton key. I mean, how do we inoculate ourselves against this feeling of unreality?
We have to support, we have to somehow support independent journalists. We have to support, I always help fundraise for public radio. We need as much support as possible. This happened after World War One, when there was a lot of propaganda that got Americans into World War One on false grounds, and there was a wave of money going to support independent journalism. So we need independent journalism. We have to worry about a lot of Fox News, which has become a propaganda outlet. We have to worry about a lot of our corporate media, which is tied to entertainment and clicks. And we have to, people have to take the time to inform themselves.
Our guest today has been Jason Stanley. He is a professor of philosophy at Yale University and the author of a new book called How Fascism Works: The Politics of Us and Them. Mr. Stanley, thank you so much for joining us today. Very, very provocative discussion, a lot of action on the phones and by email. We appreciate it.
Thank you very much.
Take care.